Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Readers and Writers on the Air, another in our occasional series of conversations about books and with authors. I'm Jackie Sauter, and with me is Betsy Capus.
Hi.
Hi, Betsy. How are you today?
I'm excited about this conversation.
I am, too. Betsy, in case you don't know, is the station's book reviewer and contributor to our online Readers and Writers Book Club, which you ought to check out. You'll find it at our website at ncpr.org. This hour, we'll be having a great conversation with you all and with our very special guest, Canadian writer Louise Penny, author of the Inspector Gamache mystery series, 8 fabulous, critically acclaimed books that have a worldwide audience. We have so much to talk about today. Great writing, what makes a good mystery, why we love the imaginary village of Three Pines, the remarkable characters in this book, and so much more. We want you all to be part of the conversation this hour, so make a note, jot down this phone number to call 1-877-388-6277. That's 1-877-388-6277. And grab a cup of tea and join us this hour. Louise Penny is joining us by phone right now from her home in Quebec. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
So nice to have you with us here. The sun is shining, and it's a pretty crisp but lovely day. Are you calling us from your home in Quebec?
I am, and in fact, I would have thought that you're calling from right next door. You're describing exactly what that I'm looking out, and there's frost on the grass, and the pond has frozen over, but not enough, obviously, to walk on. But it's one of those perfect November days.
When you write, are you looking out that window at the pond?
Yes. Well, you know, that's an interesting question. Not really. I tend to write the first drafts in the winter, and in front of the fireplace in the living room, and that really sort of looks out over the vegetable garden. Mm. Doesn't have much of a view, which is not a bad thing at all.
Yeah.
I'm not distracted. But I am distracted by the pastries I put before me as incentive to write. I once took a personality test, you know, one of those great long things I think it was one of the Women's Wear Daily or something like that. And it asked, what's your cardinal quality? Is it patience? Is it kindness? Is it love? Is it generosity? So I did the entire questionnaire, and it turns out that my cardinal quality is sloth. I didn't know that was one of the options, but it was. So, and it came as absolutely no surprise. So in order to get me to write, I put pastries in front of or beside the computer.
Well, it sounds like a pretty cozy way to write, in front of the fireplace with pastries. And maybe that's one of the reasons that there's such a strong and wonderful food theme in all of your books. Betsy has a question.
I do, Louise. Hi. I'm a Johnny-come-lately to your series, and I've read the last two, so I don't know Three Pines, but I'm curious. You go from your book set in your beautiful little village south of Montreal, and then the second-to-last one is set in Quebec City in the winter, and this new one, The Beautiful Mystery, is set in a remote monastery in northern Quebec, and I'm curious why that setting.
You know, I think you may have missed a book in between.
Oh, okay.
And I want to know what's wrong with you. Why?
Sorry.
Honestly, someone should lock the door and force her to read all the books in order. So, you know what? You're quite right. Book 6 was set in Quebec City, and then there was a book in between called A Trick of the Light, and that was back in the village of Three Pines, which is a little village by the Vermont border. And then now this one is set in the remote monastery. I initially thought I would write all the books set in the village of Three Pines, and it soon became clear that it wouldn't sustain the murder rate.
Exactly.
So I realized after the third book that I really had to set every second book somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I've done. And when it came to writing book 8, we have a monastery. Quebec has a lot of monasteries. I know, actually, Vermont has a lot of monasteries.
Yeah.
It's quite famous. A lot of people go to Vermont, as you know, to do retreats. And there's a monastery fairly close to us where the monks have taken, if not a vow of silence, it's a strong suggestion of silence.
Mm-hmm.
And they sing Gregorian chants. And And I've been really fascinated by a community of men who choose to live together, who manage to live together, which can't be the easiest thing in the world. You know, despite, you know, the help of a higher power, it's still, they're still human, and the challenges of a community of men living together and then put them in isolation, and then fold into that the question of music,
mm-hmm.
and how powerful music is, and particularly plain chant, which they believe is the voice of God, or the word of God sung in the voice of God, and the power of that as well. So I really, for me, it just, it resonated completely, and then have that environment shattered by the worst possible crime of murder, and how good men react to that.
Right. I kept, you said it so that there's really no chance it could have been anybody outside of the monastery, but that did sort of my thought through. Maybe it's somebody that snuck in, but you got it pretty far away there.
You'd make a good monk.
Yeah.
What they kept hoping. I think I saw a parachutist.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone tunneled in.
So I assume the Gilbertines is a made-up order, or is that a real order?
Well, this is one of the great joys of being a writer, is that I am godlike in my powers.
Right.
What I did, because I could not set it among an order that actually existed.
Right.
So what I did was I resurrected an extinct order. And the Gilbertines actually, I find it fascinating, they actually did exist. They were an English order of monks, but they went extinct, and I think that's probably a kind way of putting it, during the combination of the Reformation and the Inquisition. But in my telling of it, they didn't actually go extinct. They ran as far away as they could, and at that time it would be to the New World, mm-hmm. and they ran to the very edges of the New World by going into the wilderness, which is in itself, you know, an interesting issue of men who, of going into the wilderness, of monks who go into the wilderness, which obviously has a biblical connotation as well.
Right.
And went into the wilderness to seek safety from men.
That's
who
right.
were pursuing them.
From their own church.
From their own church.
So they have that kind of ambivalent relationship with Rome. In fact, they have no relationship with Rome, where they've hidden from it for...
Mm. Right, that was very interesting. There was this invisible monastery.
That's right, that nobody really knew existed.
Yeah, yeah.
But they put out this CD this recording of Gregorian chants, which... they self-recorded and they sent it down south in the hopes of raising just a little bit of money to be able to repair the roof. And unbeknownst to them, it went viral, and they have become world famous and wealthy. And the world has discovered these monks and beaten a path to their door. And so now these monks are under siege.
Yes, and it adds a lovely layer to the book, right? Not only is there a murder, there's this... factor of remaining a cloistered order or kind of going on tour and who's on which side and all that stuff. That was fun.
Thank you. Yes, I enjoyed looking at that, the fractures within a community and these men trying to genuinely, sincerely figure out what is God's will. Is it mm-hmm. God's will that they go public and share their gift of music, which they believe is a gift of God, with the rest of the world, and the peace and the calm and the tranquility that goes with that music? Is that what God is telling them, is to leave the monastery and join the world and share this gift? Or is God testing them? And in fact, what they need to do is remain true to their vows and stay within the walls. And these are good men struggling with difficult issues, and because it's hermetic, and because they are a silent order, it is taken on a darkness that perhaps it wouldn't otherwise.
And that provided a challenge for you as a writer, because we have monks who are not supposed to talk, so they have this this language of gestures and eyebrows moving and things that
I love doing that. I don't know about you, but I've been hurt by words for sure,
mm-hmm.
but I have been slayed by a turned back.
Yes.
I've been slayed by a smirk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those little things that you know, it's impossible to say, you smirked at me without sounding like an idiot, but you know they did. You know you've been violated. So I really wanted to explore that, too. I mean, who among us hasn't felt that barb?
Yes. And then, of course, Gamache's challenge is to understand this hidden language of the monks, which
yes.
was fun. I enjoyed that part, too.
Thank you.
Louise, Beautiful Mystery is a book on so many levels. It's a mystery, but it's so much more than that, as we're talking about now, the character development and all these other nuances and big ideas. Congratulations are certainly in order. I understand that the book has gone on to the next round in the Canada Reads competition.
Yes, and I didn't have to vote 2,000 times, although I was willing to.
So now, as I understand it, there are 4 or 5 other books representing Quebec, and they'll be further winnowed down over the course of the rest of the fall and winter, and then eventually a few books will be settled on for the Canada Reads. Is that how it works?
Yes, how it works is at first, for the first couple of rounds, it's a sort of a reader's choice, where you get the readers get to vote on the what's known as the long list, and then it's winnowed down to 10, and then it's winnowed down by a vote to 5, which is where we're at now. But now that it's 5 per region, which is 25 for the whole country, now a panel is put together of, I don't know who they are, I guess readers and critics and bookstore owners or whoever, and they read in their region each of the selections, and they decide. So now, obviously, my job is bribery.
Some of those pastries, maybe.
Right.
Yeah, well, if I wasn't so slothful, I might have more of a chance, but I really can't be bothered.
So the book has moved on to the next round of Canada Reads. It's on bestseller list all over the place across North America. And we have a call right now, Anne in Rochester. Hello, Anne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Anne.
Hello, Louise. Oh, my goodness. I am so delighted with your getting to that, the final short list, as it were, on Canada Reads. And I wanted to tell you that some years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I read a review of The Brutal Telling in the New York Times, which is my major source for suggestions for new books, new authors. And I read it in a couple of days. I promptly went back online and bought everything else that you had, read them all, told all my friends, and now we can barely wait till the end of the summer when the next one comes out.
Oh, and thank you. And thank you, too, a sincere thank you for not just reading the book yourself, but telling others, because I have to, I'm sure you know that there is no writing career. My dream will die if people stop telling their friends. The books will die. And so I'm very grateful to you for spreading the word. Thank you.
Well, and I think lots and lots and lots of people do that. And I follow several authors on Facebook. I don't see anyone with quite the following you have. Which is probably because there isn't anyone with quite the talent you have.
Oh, but, I'm liking you more and more.
I'm a bit of a snob, although I love mysteries, but I mentally edit every book I read, and I rarely can never find anything in yours, not even a comma out of place. So.
Well, can I ask you something about you, because you obviously have, you're a sophisticated reader of all types, as, you know, I think, probably everybody listening is. I don't read just mysteries. I read all sorts.
Sure.
But have you found that mysteries have changed in the last few years, or crime fiction?
You know, that's a very good question. And yes, I have. And I used to read all of Agatha Christie. And recently I went back to read and found it so not sophisticated that it just bored me. Even though Agatha Christie is wonderful, I think it's part of the technology and the whole change in our lifestyle that we know more now than we did then. So we need someone to take us further into our imagination
She was great at, I'm actually reading an Agatha Christie now just to kind of cleanse my palate.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely, that's been my, and I love Agatha. She really is sort of my godmother, but I hope I sort of take it a step further. But she really wasn't very good at character development. And I think that's mm-hmm. sort of one of the big things that readers want now is to feel a connection with the characters.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I, as a reader, don't care so much who done it. I do care, but that's not the reason I'm plowing through the book and turning the pages.
Anne, thank you so much for calling. I am curious. Rochester is where I grew up, but it is definitely not in North Country Public Radio's coverage area. How did you hear about the show?
I follow Louise on Facebook.
Wonderful.
And she posted a link, and I went to it.
Well, we're delighted that you took the time to call this afternoon.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Anne.
I
put it up on Facebook this morning and put the link onto your show, so it really would be great to hear from people, I guess, anywhere.
Anywhere, yeah. Absolutely. We welcome those calls. This is Readers and Writers on the Air on North Country Public Radio, and if you would like to call and pose a question or give a comment to our guest author today, Louise Penny, the number is 1-877-388-6277. That's 1-877-388-6277. Louise, it's wonderful to hear you talk. I like Anne, have read all the books in order, and I love them, and I can't wait for the next one to come up. You have such a voice as a writer, and you have a fabulous voice on the radio because before you were a writer, you were a broadcaster.
I did exactly what you did. Which is why you can see, you know, I'm sort of mentally like wrestling for the microphone.
Turning
if you have
up your
a weather forecast
or,
you'd like me to read, just send it over.
Okay, it's a deal. But I'm really curious about how you made the transition from being a journalist, writing hard news, and being a host, a CBC host. You did, if I'm remembering correctly, an afternoon show and then a morning show. How you made the transition from all of that world to the world of writing?
I've always wanted to write. It was the very first thing I wanted to do since the age of 8. But I was a very fearful child. I was never given, thankfully, so blessed, I was never given a reason to be afraid, but I think I just came out of the womb like that, just thinking that the world was a scary, dangerous, threatening place. And so even though I wanted to be a writer, I was afraid to. I was afraid of rejection. I was afraid of that I couldn't do it. I was, you know, what would other people think? So I took the ancillary route of being a journalist. I'm really, really glad I did because I got to listen to people. And, you know, a good writer, I think, is more than anything a great listener and a good observer, and those are the same qualities that you need as a host and as a journalist and that I needed. So I got to spend 15 or 20 years listening to people and watching people in all sorts of circumstances, and then I got sort of burned out. I sort of felt that I had done it all, which of course I hadn't, but that's not a good place to be, and I sort of became the sort of colleague I myself would not want to work with. So that became a problem. So I realized it really was time to do something else. And my wonderful husband, Michael, said, he saw me drag myself home one day and said, I know you've always wanted to write if you would like to do it. And he said the most wonderful thing, I think right up there with I Love You, he said, if you would like to quit work and try to write that novel, I will support you.
What a wonderful
husband.
Isn't that
beautiful?
Yeah.
I will support you. It was a beautiful thing to hear. So I did, but I announced all over CBC Radio that I was quitting work to write a book, which turned out to be a mistake because I then spent 5 years with writer's block.
I remember, you were going to write a, quote, literary book first, and then you decided.
That's absolutely right. I was going to write, and thank you for putting the quotes in.
exactly.
No, and we can talk about that, too.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, the big thing was that because of my personality, which I hope is moderated a bit with age, I felt I needed to write not just a book, but the best book ever written,
right,
which
right.
turned out to be a bit of a problem as well. So as a result, instead of writing the best book ever written or any book, I was frozen. I didn't write anything. And a few things had to happen, and it was 5 years later that I began work on Still Life, which is my first one. And I think what's one of the big things was I realized that I needed to write a book just for me and not worry about whether it was published, not worry about whether that the contract with my 8-year-old self wasn't that the book be great, not even that it be published. The contract was that it simply be finished. And I have to say, I have so little patience. I get very weary of other writers who run down other writers. Because I know how hard it is to start a book, never mind finish one. I have huge respect for people who are self-published, who have written a book and aren't published, and clearly those who win, you know, the Nobel Prize. But for me, it takes the same amount of courage to write a great book as it does to write a mediocre one.
Right. I mean, well, this might be a time to talk about process. I'm also a writer as well as a book reviewer, so I understand both sides of the equation.
Yes.
What comes first for you when you're writing gamache mystery? Is it the setting? Is it the plot? Is it the characters? What comes first?
Sometimes it's I often kind of back into it. Certainly, for the most part, it's not plot in terms of the murder. It's often a theme, something I feel I can explore and spend a year, because it takes me a year living with the book and the characters and the theme and the story, that is meaty enough to be able to explore, and one that I'm fascinated enough with. And often, I know this is going to sound sort of ridiculous, or it might, but I love poetry, and when emerging writers ask for advice, I have sort of, you know, certain things I give them, but one thing I suggest is that they read poetry. And it could be Winnie the Pooh, it could be Hallmark cards, it could be Auden. It doesn't matter, but because poets distill emotions, and they get in a couplet what I struggle to get into an entire book.
Right.
And that often is what happens, is I'll come across a poem, just a phrase in a poem, and something will hit me. And for The Beautiful Mystery, for instance, it was a line from one of my favorite works of all time, Murder in the Cathedral by T.S. Eliot, and it was the fourth temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. I loved that idea of betraying ourselves, and how easy it is to hide behind the right deed, but inside we know we're doing it for the wrong reason. And who among us hasn't done that?
And, of course, that becomes part of the plot of this one. Yes.
That's right. And that's often what happens in my books, is that I cut it out, or I make a note of whatever the couplet is, and I attach it to my laptop, so that when I'm writing and I get lost, as I always do, and I know what the spine is of the book, I know what the theme is. Oh, it's betrayal, or it's tyranny, or it's whatever is contained in jealousy, whatever is contained in that couplet.
That's great. And okay, and here's just one more question. Do you know who's going to be the murderer, or does that sort of evolve as you write?
No, I always, by the time I write, I've lived with it probably for 6 months, and I have, each book has a notebook, and so I make notes and make notes and make notes on character, on plot, on, so I always know, by the time I start writing, I know who died.
Right.
I know
right.
who did it. I sometimes don't know how. The murders, I don't think anyone really tunes in. Unlike Christie, where, you know, part of the fascination is how was someone murdered in a locked room or whatever, you know. But for me, that's never, it's often pretty straightforward. The big issue is not only who, but why.
Right, right.
You're listening to Readers and Writers on the Air on North Country Public Radio. Jackie Sauter and Betsy Capus, we're here together today with our guest, author Louise Penny, and we'd like you to join in the conversation. Here's the number to call, 1-877-388-3986. 1-877-388-6277. Again, that's 1-877-388-6277. Just pick up the phone and call and ask your question. Louise, we received quite a few emails and postings online from your fans in our listening area. And in fact, I don't know if you realize this, but there is a great affinity between this part of the world, northern New York and the Adirondacks, and the place you live in Quebec. We share not only climate and a lot of culture, too. A lot of northern New York was settled by people, Quebecois, coming down. And a lot of your area, I believe, the eastern townships, were settled to some degree by loyalists coming up who didn't want any part of the Revolutionary War.
That's right.
And that's right, yes. And we got an email. I just want to read some of this from Elizabeth. And Elizabeth says she's read all your books, and she adores them all. Penny is delicate and tender in her word choices, her scenarios, leading you into a world that is oh so familiar but far more intimate than even your own. I grew up in northern New York and spent much of my childhood on provincial dirt roads in Ontario and western Quebec. I now live elsewhere, and the books transport me back home in the geography of my heart and the fiction of Three Pines. Bravo to one of the best writers there ever was. In my top five for life, best series. Thank you, Louise, for sharing your vision with us. There you go. Are you blushing?
I am. Isn't that beautiful?
It is. And, you know, a lot of the emails and calls I've got about the show today, people wanting me to, would you please ask her this? Would you please ask her that? The one thing that everybody wants to know is either, where is Three Pines and can I go there? Or, well, I know it isn't real, but she must have modeled it on some town. Where is that town and how do I go there? Do you want to talk a little bit about the incredible sense of place that you created across the books with Three Pines?
Oh, yes, I would love to. And Elizabeth, if you're listening, thank you so much for that really beautiful message. And of course, Elizabeth also obviously talked about sense of place. And that, for me, that was when I was thinking about Still Life, the first book, and not really expecting that it would be published. But hoping, of course, I was hoping for the best. And I wanted it to be clearly set in Canada, that there'd be no sort of ambivalence. I didn't want to set it in the States or in England or in France, even though it would have been easier to sell, perhaps. Mm. But for me, my books are, among other things, I hope, they're genuine love letters to this part of the world, because I've searched much of my life, my adult life, for home and for a place to belong. I think as a journalist, I was something of a gypsy. I spent 2 years here and 2 years, always with the CBC, but moving on and moving mm-hmm. on. And I got to the stage in my 30s where I think I was lonely and I wanted to set down roots. And I really considered where, and I decided to move here. And I have not regretted it for an instant, even though it's not necessarily the easiest place to live, Quebec, because of the politics and the language. But gosh, I love it. And I wanted to bring that love and also some of the tensions and some of the other issues to other people, so that people listening in Rochester or in the Adirondacks or in Russia would know what it feels like to live here and feel the affection I have for it, warts and all. Then there are enough warts. And so I created this, the Village of Three Pines, which is similar to where we live, but it is fictional. We just started. They filmed the first.
Oh yes,
book.
We're so excited about that. This is Still Life, right?
Yes, Still Life, exactly. And the producers kept saying exactly what you know the readers say too. It's like, you know, now we know it's fictional, but you know, are you sure you didn't base it on, you know, an existing village? Because now would be a good time to tell us.
Yeah, right.
And I have to blush and say, I'm sorry. It really, honestly, genuinely exists in my head. It's not really based on, the tone is based on my life, but the actual buildings and things are fantasy. They're my safe place. The place I go to when the world isn't as kind, when I'm not as kind, when I feel threatened, when I just need a comfortable place, when I need a when I need an extra sense of belonging in my head, I can go to the Village of Three Pines. Now, having said that, what I do want to say is that the producers searched all over this area for a village they could use, and they came upon Stanbridge East in the eastern townships, not too far from the village I live in, and they used that as the setting for Three Pines. So if anyone... Now, it doesn't really look like Three Pines, but they used some of the exteriors, and they're going to edit it together so that it looks like Three Pines. But it is, it's a beautiful little village.
Louise, I do want to talk with you more in this next half hour about your experience of being involved with the making of the film. But right now we have Susan joining us on the phone from Keene Valley. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. So I'm a fan, and I what always strikes me about when reading about Three Pines is how much, in a way, Keene Valley is like Three Pines in that people have come from away, and they all have a back, or many of them have a backstory, and that doesn't, that isn't obvious when you, you know, when you're reading the books. It's not obvious with the characters, but you know that you find out about their backstory. And I wonder if you could comment on that. And I think I'll take my comment or my answer off the air. But I am a fan.
Oh,
all
thank
right.
you. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you so
That's
much.
That's a wonderful question, because that, that also struck me when we first moved. Michael and I moved from the city, from Montreal, down into the country. And I know if I hadn't done that, the books clearly wouldn't exist either, because they're inspired by this area. But it became clear that that almost everybody, or not everybody, you know, there are a number of people who came here as a second chance to start the second half of their life or the second part of their life, and not necessarily older people, some younger, who gave up promising careers in business and decided, no, they want to be woodworkers, or they want to be glass blowers, or they want to be whatever, and they came down here. And I think that's not unusual in the countryside, particularly these days. And I think it sort of speaks to all many of our desires for a second chance. And that's part of what Three Pines is about as well, is that it's many of the people there have been given a second chance. And many of them have been wounded in some way, sort of emotionally or whatever, and they sort of stagger into the little village that that appears almost magically in a valley that doesn't exist on any map, and it's a healing place. But I don't want to make it sound mystical or anything. It's not. There's no fairy dust or any of that sort of thing. It actually exists, you know, as a fictional village exists. But there is that, I hope, that sense of rebirth.
Oh, that comes through very clearly, Louise.
Oh, I'm
absolutely
glad, 'cause that's also something that I've been very aware of, deeply aware of in my life, of that this is a second career, and how lucky I am. How lucky I am. You know, we described earlier on about sitting by the fire. How lucky. You know, it's not the easiest job in the world, but I've got to tell you, almost everybody else has a harder job than sitting by the fire with pastries writing a murder mystery.
This is Readers and Writers on the Air. We're talking with Louise Penny, author of the Inspector Gamache mystery series, award-winning series on the bestseller list, and we're so delighted to have Louise with us this hour. If you have a question, the number to call is 1-877-388-6277. Louise, we started to talk a little bit about the making of your first book, Still Life, into a film. That must have been a very difficult process, to kind of have to let go of your village and your characters. What was that like for you?
Oh, I got to tell you, there's fingernail marks all over that film. Oh, it was wretched. It was awful. It was I'd actually had a number of requests to buy the rights. And I turned down every one of them, mostly because they wanted to buy the rights to the characters and make it into a TV series. And now I have to say, my ego engaged immediately in that, and I sat forward and But upon reflection, I realize that's not something I could ever do to these characters whom I genuinely care about and I love and I feel like I'm their guardian, and it wouldn't have been the right thing to do. But I turned down every offer until this one came through, and I actually turned them down three times, but they kept coming back. And I liked that. I liked that they persevered, and we finally had a talk, and they said, well, what's wrong? Why, what do we have to do? What's your problem? What's the issue that's holding you up? And I explained it's the characters. I couldn't, I didn't trust anyone to do right by the characters, and I couldn't, there was a lot to lose and not a lot to gain. And they said, well, would it be better? Would it help you if you were one of the executive producers? And yet again, my ego leapt to the fore. And so I agreed. It wasn't just ego. There were a whole lot of other issues, obviously. But I agreed. But it's been very humbling for me to see just how unbalanced I can be at times. So it's been quite a process of trying to choose my battles, of knowing when to fight and when not to, what's worth it and what isn't, when I'm wrong, because I've been wrong often. I battled something and realized I was wrong. When to trust and when to step forward and say, no, you're wrong. It's been a really growth experience for me, I hope, a learning curve of personally as well as professionally, because this is an area that I'm not familiar with. However, as I keep saying to the filmmakers, I absolutely know nothing about filmmaking. I know everything about these characters.
Of course, and, you do.
You know,
yes.
So you're not going to mess with these characters.
So what
you know,
about
from what they wear to their hairstyles to how they talk to everything? That's my line. And I'm not sure I've always, you know, I've had as much influence as I would like, but.
Can you talk a little bit about the casting of the actor for the role of Gamache? Was that difficult? Was that easy?
No, that was very, very difficult. To be honest, part of what made it difficult was that my saying yes to making the film didn't de facto mean it was going to happen. Most films, even with the rights, obviously, aren't made, or books are never made into films. It's a long process, as I've learned, of trying to get funding, trying to get a broadcaster, trying to get them to say okay. CBC is the broadcaster, which I find personally wonderful. But CBC has suffered from atrocious cuts from, as far as I'm concerned, a Neanderthal conservative government who just keeps hacking away at our public broadcaster and our public voice. And they've practically eviscerated the show, and so they're making it very difficult for CBC Television to produce Canadian-made films, which is just ridiculous. You know, anyway, I won't go into that. I can go on and on. But as a result, CBC wasn't able to give the okay to go ahead until we were quite late, and because each of my first four books is set very clearly. In fact, each of my books is set in a season, and the seasons become a character. Yeah. The weather becomes a character in each of the books, because I want to, that helps with sense of place. But the first book is set at Canadian Thanksgiving, at the height of the leaves. Now, you get the same leaves we do, and you know the leaves only last for, you know, maybe 2 weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
So these poor filmmakers only had, you know, they didn't have a village, and they had only 2 weeks to film it, and they had, you know, a CBC that was couldn't commit until finally they could. And then when that happened, they only had about 2 months to cast, to do everything necessary. And so it was amazing to watch them pull it together. But as a result, too, we didn't have a long time to look for the main character of Gamache. I mean, everybody else could have been, you know, stick figure characters that could be made out of pipe cleaners, but you had to get Gamache right. And I think they did. It's not the man they cast. I always thought of he would be a Brit, because Gamache speaks English with a slight British accent. Although they did look in Quebec, they looked in the States, they looked in the rest of Canada, they looked in Britain. And they came upon this wonderful actor named Nathaniel Parker, to play Gamache, but he knows he's not the Gamache I have in my head. He's probably not the Gamache most people have.
You know, Louise, I think you're right about that. And I saw the photo. I think it's on your marvelous website. And before that, I had known Nathaniel Parker from, I think it was Inspector Linley. He played Inspector Linley in that series. I said, well, that's not what Gamache looks like. But when I saw the photo of him, I said, well, it's not the image in my head, but this will definitely work. So when is the film coming out?
The film is coming out, we hope, October.
Oh, okay. So we have that to look forward to. Let me just do a little business here. This is North Country Public Radio. It's 20 minutes before 12. I'm Jackie Sauter. Betsy Capus is here. Joel Hurd, our engineer. And we're having a conversation this hour with Canadian author Louise Penny, writer of the Gamache Mystery Series. And Bonnie from Potsdam wants to know how Louise developed the characters of Gamache and Jean-Guy. Well, segue to that conversation.
Gamache, initially, I came across my notes, and initially he was going to be mid-30s, in a bad marriage, probably fighting some kind of addiction, a man really at odds with himself, not a happy man. And then I thought, geez, you know, if I'm lucky enough, and this is made into a series, I'm going to have to live with this man the rest of my life, and do I really want to live? You know, now I finally get godlike powers. Why would I create a man so wretched? So I set that aside, and I also realized, you know, Anne talked about Agatha Christie, and I had heard that, you may have heard the same thing, that Christie grew very weary of Poirot very quickly, and that struck me as very sad that the rest of the world loved this character, and the only one who really grew to despise him was his own mother, his own creator. Mm. And I thought about why that was, and I think one of the reasons was that Poirot never evolved. He never grew. He never changed. He was basically the same man in the first book as he was in the very last book, almost the same age, in fact.
Yes.
So I thought, how am I going to not grow weary of Gamache? And I came to the conclusion that I needed to create a character whose company I would enjoy, a man who I could spend the rest of my life with, a man I would marry. And so I gave Gamache all the qualities I admire in a man, and I realized they're actually all the qualities I admire in a human being: integrity, humor, the courage of his convictions. He stands up for what he believes in. He has the courage to do that. He's not ever going to shoot first and ask questions later. He's a thoughtful man. And he's a man who loves deeply and is loved. And I like to explore that because I think, you know, it is so easy to find fault. It is so easy to be cynical. It takes no courage at all to be negative. It takes a whole lot of courage to be kind. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to explore that kind of courage and its place in our lives today.
And you have a great contrast with Gamache and his deputy, is not the right word, but Jean-Guy,
yes.
Jean-Guy Beauvoir, so who is a kind of a younger and angrier man.
Yes, he's more cynical. He's the before picture.
Yes, yes.
he is cynical. He's sarcastic. He's kind of brash, but he loves Gamache, and Gamache loves him, and that's kind of part of his redemption is his commitment to Gamache, although he doesn't always agree with him. But there is that trust there, and I wanted to, again, explore that, the sense of that the books, as you started out saying, are not, they're definitely murder mysteries and crime fiction, and I'm very proud of that, but they are not really about murder. They're about life and life choices, and they're about love and about belonging and about kindness and how we get there in our hearts.
Louise.
And so it's been fun to sort of watch Beauvoir evolve as he struggles with all these issues.
Mm-hmm. Louise, you know, there's a piece that appears in several of your books, Inspector Gamache when he's training new agents. He tells them the four sayings that lead to wisdom.
Yes.
I was wrong. I'm sorry. I don't know. I need help.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not things that we normally think of a police inspector telling his new agents. Because, you know, the image in our head is all about strength and that shield that's up in front of people. And he, in fact, is opening people up to admit mistake. I find that really, really remarkable.
Oh, thank you. Because, you talk about strength, and I know what you mean. But I think what I'm hoping what Gamache is giving his people is unimaginable power. The power that comes with being able to ask for help rather than the ego and the arrogance that is, in fact, you know, might initially be impressive, but is, in fact, a prison. He's trying to free up his people and giving them the power and the strength to be able to say all those things. I need help. I don't know. How else are you going to learn unless you're willing to say, I don't know? But you're right, it is unusual, and I think that's why nobody wanted the book to begin with, The Life. It was turned down everywhere, internationally. It was a colossal failure because it's so unusual, because Gamache doesn't fire off, firearms all over the place, and nobody does. There's only one murder because it's really the catalyst to look at all sorts of other issues.
I read one time that the Tony Hillerman, who's a famous mystery writer who sets his books in the American Southwest, when he first shopped around his first mystery, he was told, well, if you get rid of all that Southwestern stuff and that Native American stuff, then maybe we would buy it, which, of course, is crazy. Oh. And, you know, it's like yours. The whole spine of the book is its setting. You know?
Oh, no, that's perfect. Thank you for telling me that.
Yeah, I just love that story, you know, because that's Tony Hillerman. We immediately think of the Southwest and Native Americans, and he was told to get rid of that stuff.
So. Oh, that's perfect. And that of course, is, you know, if you're right, that's what distinguishes them, and I think that's obviously why people, enjoy my books. I'm so lucky with my publishers, which is Minotaur and St. Martin's Press in New York. They're just unbelievably good because they have never once said, let's tone down the Quebec, let's, you know, let's pretend it's in Vermont. None of that. And I think often readers are way more sophisticated and way more curious. And this is, Emily Dickinson talked about novels as being frigates that take us to places we couldn't normally go, and both emotional frigates and taking us internally into ourselves, but also allowing us to travel to Venice, to Russia, to, you know, to the American Southwest, to Quebec. They're frigates. And how awful not to take advantage of that.
Right. You put sprinklings of French throughout the book, and I assume we're supposed to assume often they're speaking in French, but of course we're reading it in English. I like the way you just introduce just a little French so that everybody remembers where we are and what we're listening to. It works.
It does.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, that's sort of the point, is again a sense of place and just enough. I've had some, less now, but particularly at the beginning, some people wrote and said, why do you do that? I don't understand what the words are. And I try to reassure them that there's no way I'm going to give a pertinent clue in French.
Right.
Or say, and the murderer is, and then give it in in the Cyrillic alphabet.
We have an email from Betsy Robinson. Her book club is reading Fatal Grace, and she's wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the title means to you.
A Fatal Grace is the second book in the series. It's set at winter, at Christmas time, and I think the books, again, you know, I do tend to talk in generalities, but one of the themes that I hope is exists in each of the books is duality, of how beautiful Three Pines is, but that is simply the veneer, that dark things happen in this beautiful place. And our own personal veneers of the public face, the public smile, and our interior thoughts that we keep to ourselves, the gap between what we say and what we feel, and that's what the title is meant to talk about, a fatal grace. Mm. A grace in itself shouldn't be fatal. Something fatal should be dark. But I wanted to highlight the sense of duality in this book, and as well as in all of the books.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Readers and Writers. I'm Jackie Sauter. Betsy Capus is here, and today our conversation is with author Louise Penny. And Joel Hurd, our engineer, you've got a question or a comment to pass along from a listener?
Yes, we had somebody call in from Canton. Janet in Canton wanted to know about the contrast and the intrigue between the French and English cultures in Quebec, how that plays into your writing. And also, do you have many French readers? Do you have any way of gauging how many of your readers are French, read in French versus in English?
I'll take that last part first. The books have actually been translated into, now I think it's 26 languages, but for the longest time, one of the last languages they were translated into was French, which was a little baffling to me. I didn't understand why no French publisher was interested. But now they are being translated, and so obviously the French readership has gone way up here in Quebec, which is wonderful. I was a little afraid at first, because thinking, what will they think of what I'm writing? Because I do write about the politics and the language and some of the intrigues and some of the stresses. The books are on the bestseller list here in Quebec, which is great, and people seem to like them. I do every now and then get emails from some French readers who don't agree with my point of view, and that's fine. I mean, who will? It is. I am writing singularly from my own experience, and I'm not making any of it up. It is my experience as an almost unilingual Anglo when I arrived, coming to Quebec, and what my perception has been. And as a journalist, too, I covered Quebec politics for 15 years, and so it's not an unsophisticated point of view, but it is definitely a biased point of view. So that plays into the books, and I think it plays in, I talk about it in most of the books. Sometimes it plays a stronger role in the book set in Quebec City, Bury Your Dead. There's certainly quite a bit of discussion about the French, the separatists, and the federalists, and the votes to succeed, and the independence movement, and all that. My experience, though, has been that all that absolutely exists. It is absolutely real. People are passionate on both sides. But on the ground where I live, I have never been made to feel anything less than completely welcome and a full member of this society. Never, from French or English. And I wanted to bring that forward in the books as well, in Three Pines, French and English do live perfectly fine together. They both speak French. They both speak English. They switch back and forth in the languages. There is an acceptance, although they don't necessarily agree with each other's politics all the time.
Mm-hmm. And they enjoy wonderful food in the bistro.
Oh, yes. When all else fails, let's go to the bistro and have a glass of wine and some cheese.
Well, now I know when I'm reading your books and there are those terrific passages about the just incredible plates that come out for diners at the bistro that's inspired by you sitting by your fireplace with those pastries.
Oh, God. You know, my thighs are a complete... You know, I blame them on my, they're definitely literary creations. I wish they were fictional.
Louise, when you're sitting there with your writing and your pastries, are you also listening to music? You mentioned how important music has been to you as a writer. Is it something you can listen to while you're writing or when you're not writing?
No, I cannot listen to anything when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. But I do listen to, each of my books has its own soundtrack. songs that have inspired me. And that's part of, you know, you asked a little while ago about what inspires a book, and it is sometimes poetry. It's sometimes a snippet of conversation, but it's can sometimes be music as well, including just instrumentals. It opens up something inside me, and this is explored in That's the Beautiful Mystery. I'm far from alone in this. It's many, many people who listen to music and find themselves transported and transcends the reality and the mundane. And that's what it does for me. So I listen to everything from Eminem to Elvis to Tchaikovsky.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left, but Louise, I can't let you go this hour without asking you if you have a favorite character. I think all your readers do. I mean, let's put Gamache aside because everybody loves him.
We'll take him off the table.
Okay.
Let me ask you, who's your favorite character?
I think I'd have to say Ruth Sardo.
I think a little therapy is in order.
For those who don't know, Ruth is the poet, more than kind of brusque and abrupt and downright rude to people, but incredibly lonely and in her core, a very gentle soul. And of course, then she has the pet duck. But I find her, and the way you have developed her through the books, it's just there's so much complexity there, so many layers. I'm always waiting for the next book to see what's Ruth going to do next, or what she's going to say next, I guess, is really what it's about.
I love writing Ruth too. Ruth is again that the duality and that we all have, but that she is this wretched, drunken, horrific train wreck of a poet. But that's her saving grace, is that she has a certain awareness, self-awareness that comes out in her poetry that is beautiful. And then she's actually born inside out, where most of us have that, as I talked about, the veneer of civility, and we know enough to keep our more wretched thoughts inside. But she's the other way around. She has all her wretched thoughts out in public, and she keeps her kindness deep, deep down inside because she's afraid to show it. But it comes out in her poetry.
Louise, since we don't have much time, do we get any hints on where is the next book, a Three Pines book?
It is.
Yeah.
It's set in Three Pines, and there's a unicorn and a vampire.
So we're moving from monks in the monastery to a unicorn and a vampire.
Yes. No,
and it'll be out in the
if
fall.
If my publishers are listening, I need to quickly say, no, that's not true. It's not true.
Right.
But I can't tell you anything more about it because of the way The Beautiful Mystery ended. I think of the books as, in fact, one long book. And I think some people are surprised that my books tend not to have everything all neatly wrapped up.
Mm-hmm.
But life is like that. And most of my books actually, they're not meant to be, it's not meant to be a marketing tool, because I figure, you know, you'll buy the next book or you won't. I don't need to do some sort of cheap marketing tool, but what I do need is for the characters' lives to clearly continue and for everything not to be nicely wrapped up, because it sure isn't in my life often. But with this next book, which is called So Far Beyond Repair, it's set in Three Pines, and a huge amount of the loose ends from all the other books, including how The Beautiful Mystery was ended, will be resolved.
Louise, we cannot wait for that book to come out.
Thank you.
Sadly, we are out of time today. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on Readers and Writers, and we'll be following all your writing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Louise.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thanks to all our listeners and everyone who's emailed and called and posted online and on Facebook. It's great to have you aboard this afternoon.